Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, we'll bring you some of the stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, it is getting worse. Bracket creep and fuel levies mean higher costs despite no VAT hike. Gen Z and millennials reshaping global investing with AI and crypto on the rise. South Africa's craft beer industry is under increasing pressure as microbreweries battle to survive. And high growth startups could unlock jobs and GDP gains, but they need stronger support. It's Wednesday, the 28th of May. So I think many of us still have a craw stuck in our throats after the budget and are only coming to terms with the impact right now. That VAT increase may have been scrapped in budget 3.0, but South African consumers, let me tell you, are far from being off the hook. Hike in fuel levies, no adjustment for inflation in personal income tax brackets. Households are quietly being squeezed by what experts call hidden costs. What's the result? Well, rising transport, food and tax bills, all without an increase in take-home pay. I want to explore this in a little more detail with Deanne Sherman, Process Development and Change Manager at National Debt Advisors. So Deanne, on paper, and a warm welcome to you, all of this looks like consumers were spared with no VAT hike, but you're going to tell me that we're not really better off, are we?
Yeah, unfortunately, government had to find some way to make up for the deficit. And unfortunately, that is through increase in the fuel levy as well as an unadjusted tax bracket. So unfortunately, this does mean that consumers are still going to foot the bill, just in different ways. You know, the advantage of not having a VAT increase is that not everything's going to be more expensive. Only certain things are going to be more expensive now, and those are consumer products that are usually linked to the price of petrol and to an increasing price of petrol, leading to an increase in inflation for those related products.
And Deanne, that's a real knock-on effect, because if I'm not mistaken, that fuel levy increase kicks in next week, and it's going to make a big dent on household budgets, and particularly, as so often happens, for lower-income families.
Definitely. And just to give you some perspective, so with the increase in the fuel levy, the total taxes on fuel will amount to about a third of the price of petrol. So that just speaks into how much government is hedging their bet on fuel as a way to try and resolve the budget deficit that's in place, as well as to try and turn things around in terms of their reliance on debt itself. As well as the fact that as fuel now increases, or the price of fuel increases, we're obviously going to be paying more for petrol, which also means that transportation costs are going to increase, consumer goods are going to increase.
So none of this is particularly good news. You are very close to the coalface as far as consumer behavior is concerned. Are your clients already starting to show signs of strain, or do you think, Deanne, the worst is still to come?
The worst is definitely still to come. Currently, fuel, the price of oil and price of petrol is fairly low, which means that as those prices increase, we'll definitely start seeing the effects. Now, interestingly enough, we do see a lot of the effects of global events affect consumers directly here. So, for example, when we saw Trump cut spending on research as well as investment into our healthcare, we saw that a lot of healthcare workers, their incomes were cut, and those healthcare workers were under debt review. And we're going to see the same thing here, where an increase in the fuel levy is definitely going to have an effect on all consumers.
For somebody who earns an average income and trying to stay afloat, the advice would be to start making immediate budgeting changes, all well and good. But for so many people, they've done that already. They've got no place to go.
Yeah, so consumers are, ironically enough, in a very similar position that government is in, is that there really isn't that much wiggle room anymore. There really isn't that much room to cut expenses or to try and grow your income in order to maintain your livelihood. And this is just an unfortunate fact, is that in any sort of healthy growing economy, inflation is a constant factor, but things like added taxes really do have a huge effect on consumers as a whole. And so consumers' budget always has to be dynamic. It always has to change according to the times. And it's going to require certain sacrifices to be made at certain points in time, while during other points in time, you'll be able to loosen up a bit. So for example, when interest rates get cut, that is where you have a bit more room to breathe, because now you've got less money that's going to be spent on debt repayments. While when interest rates increase, you know, that's where the taps are closing and you need to kind of tighten your belt. Same thing applies to this, is that our budgets have to be dynamic and have to adapt to the times.
Do you think that creditors are becoming a little more sympathetic in this economic climate? And I have a funny feeling that could be wishful thinking. Or are collections themselves becoming more aggressive?
I think that credit providers have always had a very similar approach regardless. And that is that, and this is something that a lot of consumers don't understand, is if you are struggling, approach a credit provider. Tell them you're struggling. They're more than willing to see what they can do to help, because they also understand that what happens to you right now is temporary, but in the long term, you might actually get back on your feet and you might be able to pay. And the cost of collections, you know, most credit providers don't want to go through that. They're willing to take, you know, take it on the chin for a month or two, as opposed to now having to, you know, spend money on collection efforts or eventually sell your debt off and have to write off a certain portion. So approaching a credit provider is always the first step. And then from there, if you see that your situation isn't sustainable, then you have to look at other alternatives, like, for example, debt review or administration or any of the other debt relief measures that are in place.
But often people don't do that, and there's always the risk, and I think it's an increasing risk, that consumers feeling that pressure that you've outlined will turn to unsecured lenders or short-term loans, and that, of course, makes the situation worse.
Definitely, and we can definitely see that there is a lack of education, consumer education, as to what you can do and what you should do if you're struggling with your debt and how you go about that. This is where consumer education is going to alleviate a lot of unnecessary pressure and stress on the consumer, knowing that you need to speak to your credit provider, have an open conversation with them, and find solutions to your problems.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Deanne Sherman, Process Development and Change Manager at National Debt Advisors.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The retail investment world is undergoing a quiet revolution. Younger generations are not only investing earlier, but they are doing it differently. There's more trust in artificial intelligence, embracing cryptocurrency and turning to social media for financial advice. So what's the picture in South Africa? Well, the picture is somewhat nuanced. Confidence is high, but debt obviously remains a major challenge. And I think it's fair to say that financial literacy gaps persist. So I want to discuss the findings now of the new Global Retail Investor Outlook. It's a collaborative study by the World Economic Forum, Robinhood, and Boston Consulting Group. And in that respect, we're joined by Dean Frankel, Managing Director and Partner at BCG, who leads their asset and wealth management work across Western Europe, South America, and Africa. Dean, a very warm welcome. So this research, it paints a very different picture of today's investor. So are you able to tell me who the typical retail investor is in 2025 and how their approach has changed?
Yeah, well, firstly, it's great to be here today. And it's really a pleasure to have co-authored the report because, as you say, the world is changing and retail investing, I think many have thought was a bit of a fad during COVID. It hasn't really gone away. We see the growth of 20-odd% year on year, and it's I think here to stay. The problem, as you mentioned, is that the retail investor is changing, and it's changing in good ways, but also in bad ways. Participating in capital markets should be one of the most powerful ways to build long-term wealth, but there are real barriers. We start with education. 45% of investors, or of non-investors rather, say they don't know how to invest. So there's really a barrier to getting to participate in markets. Only 40% of retail investors use a financial advisor. Many rely on TikTok or YouTube. And while social media can be empowering, it can also be very misleading. And then there's a big issue around trust. So 63% of retail investors globally say they'd invest more if they trusted the system. And, you know, we see the people being afraid of hidden fees, fine print, and institutions that sometimes seem to play by different rules. So when you put all those things together, and when you throw AI into the mix, the world is going to change going forward, and it's a really interesting topic that needs a lot more debate. Mm.
When you talk about trusting the system, what in fact does that mean, and what does the system need to do then in order to regain that trust?
So it's a great question. When we ask questions around trust, we're asking questions on what would encourage you to A, participate, and what would encourage you to participate more in financial markets? And actually, we found in South Africa, and actually in many of the emerging markets, people had more trust in some of the financial institutions than in more developed markets. What does it mean? It means that people feel as though they aren't being lied to. They feel as though that they... the institution that they're partnering with has their best interest at heart, and it's a key driver, because as we see in the data, participation in investing is lower than it should be, and if you don't participate, you do miss out in capturing financial wealth and the opportunities ahead of you. So it's a really, really critical driver that needs to be addressed. In terms of how to address it, your question, many different things that can be put in place. I think really addressing those drivers around access, education, trust, and then actually having the financial incentives to really participate as well. So many countries have well-publicized and well-documented tax-free, tax-incentivized structures being put in place, but it's really about increasing those and increasing access to those. And everyone can play a part, be that policymakers, governments, and also the financial institutions themselves.
Dean, I'm not surprised when the work or the survey reveals that there's a clear trend towards trusting artificial intelligence for investment advice. I guess that's inevitable. But I wonder if there's enough realization of the risks and I guess the rewards in the shift.
Yeah, it's again, a great question. I think in terms of the risks, they are real. We know about hallucinations with AI models. We know about essentially wrong information being provided. But at the same time, most of the information that is available is probably better. And if we speak about the issues around access, education, and trust, you know, the data shows that people are very respondent or very, very sensitive and very open to trusting AI. I think 42% of South African investors said that they would trust an AI advisor. That's almost double the rate of what you see in the UK. Many people, and 60% of South African respondents, have struggled with meeting debt or near short-term financial issues. And really, if there's an easy way at your desktop that can help you do that, it's a very convenient and I think a simple way to try and help, not necessarily solve, but try and help the solution going forward. Clearly, as you say, there is a risk associated with the wrong information getting into the wrong hands, but hopefully increased information should help.
And just a quick one in conclusion, more than half of Gen Z investors now hold crypto or alternative assets, if I read this correctly. I wonder if these allocations are aligned with their actual risk profiles, though.
I would agree with you. I think we were actually quite, shocked in a bad way, but interested in a good way with some of that data. And actually, when you read the report, and I encourage your listeners to do so, it's more a question of awareness of financial products. And I think what you're finding is those firms that are able to better market directly to customers through digital marketing are able to better increase their awareness of certain products, and actually the awareness of more traditional assets like stocks or long-term bonds are much, much lower. And it clearly, as you say, in a more diverse portfolio, you'd want a mixture of all things, and probably not to have your largest allocation in crypto.
Dean Frankel, thank you very much indeed. I appreciate your time.
Remember when you had to hurry up and wait, and cars could only run on fossil fuels? Well, hurry up and catch up. You don't need diesel power, you just need a second electric motor. With Volvo plug-in hybrids, you can drive electric in the city, switch to fuel for the long haul, or combine both when you want it all. So what are you waiting for? You're late for your test drive. It's safe to be brave with Volvo.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, I don't think it's an understatement to say that South Africa's craft beer industry is facing something of a crisis. Why do I say that? Well, in April, 5 microbreweries shutting down. They've cited a lack of funding, high excise duties, intense competition, and also the prevalence of illicit trading. That last one is a big problem. Now, these closures have resulted in hundreds of job losses in this very niche sector. I think I'm correct in saying there are about 200 microbreweries in the country, and many of them specialize in craft beers. And the industry is, as a result, grappling with real sustainability challenges. So let's talk a little bit more about this. I'm going to have a conversation with Charlene Lowe, who is the Chief Executive Officer of the Beer Association of South Africa. I want to look at structural pressures on the sector and what can be done to support its survival and growth. And Charlene, in spite of the big beer players in South Africa, this small niche micro sector is absolutely critical to the industry, isn't it?
Yes, thank you so much for having me. This industry is quite critical. I believe it's one of those industries that is a little forgotten, if one can put it that way, in terms of its impact, particularly around job creation and stimulating the economy in which that particular brewery is located, because without a doubt, it employs local people from where it, you know, the town or the city where that particular brewer is situated. So the impact of, you know, these brewers closing down is quite significant, to put it very mildly.
Let's look at some of the issues facing the sector, if we can. Firstly, I did mention high excise duties. How does that impact the financial viability of smaller scale operators compared to some of the larger producers?
Excise is levied against alcohol manufacturers, particularly in this context, beer manufacturers, in the same way, regardless of their size. And so while the bigger brewers, to some extent, and perhaps to a larger extent, can absorb the impact of excise, the smaller brewers are unable to do that. So it often then turns out to be a pass-through onto a consumer, and that's what then makes the price of craft beer so much more expensive, because that cost could not be absorbed. But naturally, what then tends to happen is they outprice themselves in the market and can never really scale and compete, because their pricing is in essence quite unaffordable for the average consumer.
So you look at that problem. I also mentioned the prevalence of illicit alcohol trading that is obviously having an impact on legitimate microbrewing businesses. Put the two together and one can see why these breweries are in trouble.
Absolutely. We are, as a legitimate industry, competing with an illicit industry, so to speak, an illicit sector. It is thriving. And we now know that you have an illicit sector that is in the region of about 30% of the alcohol sector. And, you know, the revenue loss for government from that particular sector is in the region of about 22 billion annually. And so the competition that it creates is one that is quite significant. It's obviously costing the industry in terms of margins, in terms of sales, in terms of revenue, because there is an alternative that a consumer will go for, which is illicit, which is cheaper. And oftentimes they, outprice the legal alcohol sector, if one can put it that way. So quite unfortunate, but this is where I suppose as a sector we now need to educate consumers around illicit, the dangers, the health dangers in particular, because there are a lot of times that some of this illicit alcohol is concocted alcohol from various types of, shall I say, chemicals that are not good for human consumption. But it is a cheap alternative for most consumers, unfortunately.
And Charlene, given the problems that you've then just outlined, I would imagine it's becoming more and more difficult for people to look at microbreweries and say, well, should I be investing in something like this? And it's not only private investors, but also the funding agencies.
Oh, absolutely. The alcohol industry, sadly, particularly from an SMME point of view, has been, shall I say, looked at not in a very positive light. And we have seen that these SMME brewers are not finding joy with a lot of these funding agencies that have been established to, in fact, support SMMEs in the country. There's an exclusion, albeit an unwritten one, of SMMEs that are in the alcohol sector. And so what tends to happen is, in this instance, you have brewers that are finding that they are in a sector that is very expensive. So for starters, to start up a brewery is significantly expensive. I think just the average startup cost is sitting at about 2 million rand to 5 million rand just for a small microbrewery. And of course, once you start scaling yourself, it goes well into the 20 millions and above. And so already there is a barrier to access the industry. And once you're in the industry, there are the challenges, of course, around route to market, distribution, all of which pose a significant nightmare for these smaller brewers. So it's quite a tough environment that does require a little bit more support from these funding agencies to allow these SMMEs to grow and to impact more meaningfully in the economy.
So let's look at solutions now. Are there specific support mechanisms or policy changes that your association is either advocating for or would advocate for to assist these struggling microbreweries?
Indeed. Part of what we have been lobbying government on is indeed to look at a different excise or taxation structure for microbrewers. And this is something that we're saying is premised on benchmarks that we have seen and best practices that we have seen in other countries where larger brewers and smaller brewers are certainly not taxed in the same way. And of course, that idea and that notion of them being smaller brewers is then taken into account when one deals with excise. And so we're saying, let's look at these. And we've provided our submissions to government in this regard and hoping, of course, that as they review the excise policy framework, this is something that finds its way in a revised excise policy into the future. One of the other things, of course, is that we do believe that there are far more onerous requirements, if one can put it that way, in terms of the Liquor Act. And we need to find a situation where that type of regulation, of course, also is looked at, particularly around the cost issue. You know, application costs exceed 15,000 Rand. And if I just, you know, share with you just what I've just indicated around the cost of establishing a microbrewery, in addition to some of these very high application and licensing costs, it also just creates a bit of a limitation for these microbrewers and SMMEs that are trying to come into the industry, so to speak. So those are some of the low-hanging fruit, if you will. And of course, our lobbying has to extend then into the space of these particular funding agencies where we try and, I guess, show them a different light of this particular industry, show the amount of, shall I say, contribution that these SMMEs have in job creation, in stimulating economy, the relationship with these SMME brewers in tourism, and just how much opportunity there is out of these brewers if given the right support and enabling, shall I say, support.
Thank you very much indeed. That is Charlene Lowe, who's the Chief Executive Officer of the Beer Association of South Africa.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, with South Africa's growth forecast downgraded to just 1.5% by the International Monetary Fund for this year and internal uncertainty mounting, it's fair to say, I think, that the country urgently needs a new or at least a well-serviced economic engine. And for Phumzile Chifunyise, the managing director of Simodisa, it's a collaborative research and policy design organization, that engine is very clear: high growth startups. She believes that these are the companies that can drive jobs, attract investment, and as a result generate meaningful GDP contributions. But the sense is they're being throttled by outdated policies, heavy red tape, and risk-averse funding institutions. So let's dive into that story. Phumzile, very warm welcome. So if high growth startups are so critical, according to your argument, why do so few scale successfully?
Hi, Jeremy. Thank you so much for having us. Yeah, I think you painted the picture quite well. We at Simodisa, we are the secretariat of the SA Startup Act movement, and we are essentially a group of high growth tech startups, investors, academia, as well as just supporters of high growth startups that are looking to see more and more of these specialized businesses increase in the country. We know that they grow at an accelerated rate. These are businesses that generate 100 million in the first 5 years. They specialize in technology. They're either focused on technology or they're enabled by technology, and they spend a lot of their resources on research and innovation, and they're generally funded by private investors. And I suppose back to your question as to why are they so few, I think as you outlined, first of all, the understanding of what a high growth tech startup is in the country is a little bit complex and nuanced in the country. We traditionally know startups to be businesses that are small, that are starting out, whereas we are seeing in the global context and model, as well as even in the continent, tech startups are businesses that really grow at an accelerated rate. You think of traditional startups such as your Googles, your Metas. In South Africa, we've had quite a few, your Time Banks, Sweep South, Clickatel, Yoko, and the list goes on. However, then there's not a lot of them. There's just under 500 of them. And the economic climate of the country is one such that they can't really grow at that fast pace if they are leveraging only on the South African market. So the market is not big enough. And then number two, our regulatory and policy framework in South Africa is a little bit challenging. We've got red tape. If they want to bring in capital from offshore, the process to get the funds into the country as well as to deploy to investors is quite onerous. You also have little incentive for private capital investors to invest into early stage startups, where a lot of them that are coming up are. So we need to increase incentives towards that, as well as the limited skills in this particular sector. A lot of the skills is offshore. Yeah, so
all
I
right.
think those
so
conditions.
Let me, so that all of that makes sense. Let me pick you up on the red tape thing. I often feel that this has become a catch-all excuse for any kind of obstacle. Is red tape really the problem, or often is it just weak local business models that are perhaps more to blame?
I do agree. We've somehow managed to overuse the word, and it's become sort of something that a lot of people are hiding behind. But I think it can be a combination. On the regulatory front, you can really do very little to operate and to grow your business if there is, number one, no legislative framework to increase your capacity, how you work, how you get talent into your business, how you get funds into your business. So within the startup environment, there is no legislation that is focused specifically on tech startups. We are seeing that in Africa, there's about 13 countries across the African continent and other parts of the continent that have these startup legislations that really make it easy for businesses to start and to grow and to get funds into their businesses and to equip themselves with the right skills. But if the legal framework is not there to support you, that is red tape. The business models are there. Of course, the landscape is quite broad. So you're seeing that in the early stage, these startups within the tech startup realm do really need support in order to know how to capacitate themselves from a legal front, to capacitate themselves from a skills perspective. So, of course, the business model needs to be improved, and it does so the more and more the business grows and as you accelerate up the ladder. However, the business model of a startup is one that is quite strong and that has been successful around the world. So if the model is correct, then limitations become few. But if the legal framework is the largest barrier, then it's absolutely red tape.
So how then do you start to accelerate that process? And I would also suggest to you that it would be difficult, because this funding pullback that we have referred to is also as much about global conditions, weak global conditions, as much as the local policy that you've just outlined to me.
Absolutely. I mean, we are seeing that the level of foreign direct investment in the country is really slowing down. And of course, it's testament to the economic conditions in the country, hence why you would have the IMF who projects such low levels of growth rates, which is far beyond or below the NDP's projected growth rates of 5.4% by 2030. So you're seeing that FDIs being that low means that these startups really aren't able to grow at a rate that we're looking for, yes.
Just a final one then, and let me put you on the spot. Against the backdrop of what you've outlined to me, what is the one policy change that you would like to see from the presidency today that would make a tangible and beneficial difference?
I can give you three and give you two better. Number one, we believe as an ecosystem builder and people that engage with stakeholders, policymakers within government, specifically on a day-to-day basis through various interventions, whether it be dialogues, whether it be our white paper that we've drafted, that number one, we need to have relaxed exchange controls, and having reforms within the exchange controls will be able to make it easier for high growth startups to attract funds from offshore, and it'll also enable local VCs to be able to increase the pool of funds that we bring into the country. Number two, we also believe that we need to have incentives for private investors in the country to invest into, especially early stage startups. We know that we've got various private investor mechanisms that exist, but a lot of them fund your Series A type and level of startup businesses, and very limited of that goes towards early stage startups, and which is where a lot of black tech and digital and innovation-based businesses are at. So we need to have some sort of, an incentive mechanism that's going to incentivize a private investor and private investment capitals to fund early-stage startups. The third one is therefore for there to be a digital skills visa, where we can make sure that startups that are in South Africa are able to employ digital skills, especially those that are not already available in the country.
Lots of food for thought there. Phumzile Chifunyise, thank you very much indeed, Managing Director of Simodisa. I appreciate your time. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye to you, and thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.